What do you think it means to be a person?
I don't know.
Me either. Really. Say scratch that again.
Scratch that a fan.
I'm Caitlin Metz, a non-binary illustrator and designer.
I'm Rebecca Tossig, a disabled storyteller and writer.
And this is Scratch That, Parenting and Reparenting Off Script.
A podcast for people trying to parent and person at the same time.
Head over to our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast, for show notes and a transcript of today's episode, and also to join the conversation.
Thank you for being here. Hi, friends.
Happy Monday. Today is a very exciting day. I try to remember how long ago it was, maybe 6 months or something. I went to my favorite local bookstore, Left Bank Books, and at the register, after I'd already gotten like way too many books, there was this incredible book sitting up at the register being featured, Special Topics in Being a Parent, A Queer and Tender Guide to Things I've Learned About Parenting Mostly the Hard Way. And I, without even opening it, I just like added it to my pile of books. I was like, I need this in my life. And so I devoured it in one sitting and like with laughter and tears, like actual tears, which is a whole thing when you're on Lexapro. So it was deep. And so I've talked to Rebecca often. I was like, I want to interview the person who is in this. And so then we finally reached out to you and you were immediately like, yes, it works. And then I was like, oh my God. Often we're like scheduling way out. And so I was like, great. So then I started researching you and I was like, oh my God, I didn't know who this person was. And then I mentioned you to my like queer librarian friend and they were like, Caitlin, this was like the father of trans people. This person is quintessential. And so then I was like anxiety pooping and I was like, I don't know what to do. So then I went on a long tangent of just like trying to research you to the point that it would seem like I was one of the queers who has like leaned on your wisdom for years, but that's not true. And so, but in some of that research, I found a video, I think from like 11 years ago, but you said something about how creating memoir-esque work is really strange because at the time that you write it, that is true and who you are. And then like that keeps living in the world, but you keep evolving. And so in honor of me actually not genuinely knowing that much about you and in honor of the fact that you have been just like evolving and changing, I would love to hear from you. Like, what is it that you would have us know today about who you are? Also, this is Bear S. Bergman, everyone.
actually, it's S. Bear Bergman.
S. Bear Bergman. Wow.
Let's start there. Hi, good morning. How are you? I see that you really took a slingshot approach in every part of this. And I'm sorry. I did not mean to freak you out by saying I can do this in 3 days. It wasn't like a test. I just I am about to leave on a 6 week long summer trip with my husband and children in various permutations. So I apologize for the short and evidently a little stressful timeline.
Exciting. No, we're so delighted. We are so delighted. I'm just prone to anxiety.
And I'm so glad we caught you right before your like long trip. That's perfect.
Truly. What do I want you to know about me now? It is definitely true that writing a book that is in some ways a memoir when you are 28 years old is a really interesting choice that I would not recommend to most people, especially because I am now 50 years old. And I wrote that book 20 and a bit years ago, and that's wild, that first one. What would I say about myself now? I am a father of three children. I'm now and have for the last 18 years lived in Canada. I am married to a guy that I still really like, which is very helpful, and who is also a great co-parent. I'm still writing books. This is the most recent one. I'm also a storyteller and performer. I do a lot of that when I'm not doing this. That's probably enough, like, bare bones biographical information for now. I like very strong coffee and novels with a lot of plot. I like it when a lot happens in my books.
I love these details. I just read your book over the special topics in being a parent book over the weekend. And I felt like after finishing it, I wanted so much to sit with the person who composed it and just know more about you. And one of the things that came up for me reading this book, Caitlin and I lament often about how so many parenting books are horrible. So many advice books in general, and parenting advice books particularly, can just be like agony. And I think hopefully it's clear right away that we did not experience, we experienced the opposite with your book. And I think one of the reasons that I felt so receptive and affectionate for this book and the writer was that you did such a wonderful, wonderful job of toggling, and I don't even know if these are the right words, but we'll play with them a bit, like a sense of humility and authority in the way that you approach the advice. I mean, I think even starting with that first chapter, I was a perfect parent before I had actual children, just made me love you and want to talk about parenting with you. I think it's this balance between like you have obvious wisdom to share and you know it and you know your wisdom and you offer it without judgment, which I think is a really hard balance to hold. And I think it also, ironically, maybe not ironically, that balance makes for really good parenting, right? Like the, I know some things and I also can offer them to you without judgment, or I know some things, but I'm also open and curious at the same time. So it's like the sturdiness and the openness that I'm really captivated by, both as a parent, as a human, as a writer. And so I just wanted to hear you talk about that balance that you embody. You know, like, is that something that, is that balance, is that something that's taken you a long time to cultivate?
I think what I would say is, part of the reason I got into advice giving in the first place was that I often did not like the advice that was available. Sometimes I really did, but there was, it felt to me like a vast gulf between the few people whose advice work I was like, oh yes, this is interesting and helpful. And then a lot of people who just sort of seemed to be, you know, doing yet another rehearsal of like the conventional wisdom, but this time we're going to give it a jaunty scarf. And I didn't love that vibe. My husband likes to say, like, there's this thing that I do, which he refers to as achieving peak fuck it, which is the point at which, like, sometimes what happens is, you know, there's something in the world or the way that it's done, I'm like, I don't love this. And then I look around to see, is somebody doing a good job? And if so, great, then I can leave it alone. But then sometimes I can't really find anyone who's doing it in the way I would like to see. And then even still, I will just sort of wait for a little while. Like, okay, but surely this is, right? Like, we're moments away from a better version. But then after a while, sometimes I reach a point where, and the hallmark of peak fuck it is, well, I can't make this any worse. And, you know, that is how I ended up writing an advice column, and also how I ended up founding Flamingo Rampant, our children's press, and some other things. They're all moments where I was like, I don't really love the landscape as it exists, and I think I can do better, but also I'm pretty sure that even if I do a terrible job, I cannot make this situation worse. So let's give it a try. The true thing about me is that I have had to work really hard to figure out how to do a lot of the people stuff. Like, it doesn't come naturally to me. I was raised in a family where there wasn't a lot of modeling of how to be, like, reflective about my impact on other people. And so as I left my, you know, family of origin and moved out and struck out on my own, it started to become really clear to me that my intention and my impact often were not in alignment. Like, I would have all the good intentions in the world, and that was not reflected in how people experienced what I was saying or doing. And that was really hard, because I wanted to be good at peopling. And I think partly it was because, you know, the primary thing I think that my parents and other family members were worried about when I was a child and teenager was that I was not getting gender right at all. And so I don't think anyone paid any attention to anything else about how I was doing as a person, because there was this like one great flashing alarm that nobody could take their eyes off of. And so when eventually it became clear to me that I had not learned any or many good skills, I had to do it all from scratch. Like, I really had to take apart a lot of very common, regular kinds of human interaction and figure out through trial and error. Which, the thing about trial and error that I don't think we talk about enough is it's like error, 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 success. So you get, there's a lot of failure before you start achieving something that you feel okay about. And having like really sorted a lot out as an adult, it then became clear to me that, you know, I had some useful information about all of the, you know, I could sort of detail, like, I did this and it didn't work out, I did that and it didn't work out, I did this and it didn't work out, and then eventually this worked, which was great for me. So if you would like to have this impact, here is a way that you can, you know, if you would like to get to the corner of people feeling valued and not, you know, rehearsing everything in the refrigerator as a way to make them feel valued, here are some steps. And I think, I don't know that I've ever heard it expressed as, you know, a place of, I don't know, tension or some, but in a good way, like, you know, traction maybe is a better word between humility and authority. But I think that probably is what accounts for it. Like, I remember being bad at a lot of things, and I remember how challenging it was to try to figure them out. So I definitely do not think of myself as a person who, like, is effortlessly good at any of these things and therefore hold some kind of, I don't know, moral authority about it. I think of myself as someone who has climbed out of a lot of interpersonal ditches and has a relatively good idea of how I did it because it was all, you know, iterative, right? Like, I messed it up this way, then I messed it up a different way, then I messed it up yet another different way. And even still, you know, some of the things that I know intellectually are the right way in the moment, sometimes I don't, right? Like, I know what I'm supposed to do, but also in that perfect example, nobody is crying.
Yes.
And I think that that vibe comes through in the books in a way that is useful. I also felt very aware that a lot of parenting advice, especially with this one, there's another advice book before this one, Special Topics in Being a Human. And it is basically the same concept, different topic area. With the parenting book particularly, I just felt so aware of the amount of judgment that comes with parenting and how everybody wants to tell you about what you're doing wrong, especially strangers, which I was always like, who are you again? I don't, why are you even talking to me? What is happening?
Yep.
Like, we are not even hello friends. Why are we suddenly you're doing it wrong friends? That's not how this works. And so I think as I was writing Special Topics in Being a Parent, I was even more attentive to the idea of not wanting people to feel like, you made reference to the fact that a lot of parenting books are terrible, which I think is true. And I think there are several different ways in which they are terrible. But one of my least favorite is the one where the book is like, you're doing everything wrong. And you're definitely screwing up your child or children even as we speak. But don't worry, I am here to tell you how to change everything about your parenting so that your child will be, you know, not a bank robber or whatever when they grow up. But I don't love that. And so, you know, when writing this book, one of the things that I was sort of always thinking about was, okay, how do I give advice in a way that sort of feels like you can pick what feels resonant and maybe helpful right now and leave the rest alone until or unless its day arrives to your household, to your parenting. And I think there, I actually ended up sort of writing that in a couple of places.
You did.
And it made it into the illustration, sort of a general, you know, if this feels useful, great. And some of, not all of it will be relevant to everyone at all times. But really the truth about why I think the book feels like it contains, you know, both humility and authority is that I really had to put every single thing together from like a box of parts. You know, I did not get much that felt like I could just use it as it was. And you can sort of imagine somebody walking in with like a greasy cardboard box that clanks alarmingly. And dropping it on the floor and being like, okay, here you go. And so I think, if anything, I tried to make a useful set of, like, instructions for assembling all of the odds and bobs in that box into some usable stuff, if you want it.
Yes, yes. I got really emotional listening to you describe that because that that makes a lot of sense. And Caitlin, before we hit record on this, before you hopped on, I was trying to describe the feeling to Caitlin, and it was like, it feels so much more like as opposed to you standing on top of the mountain, pointing down at us, telling us what to do. It's like you are in the trenches with us. I think there's even some language at one point when you're like, you say something like a prayer for all of us, you know, like or something, you know, like it's, we're all here. We're all in it and we're in it together. And, but you've maybe, you've gleaned those things as you've gone along. And it made me want to listen to you so much more and really like trust the things that you were sharing.
The thing about parenting books is that it's like so specific and it's so child focused, I feel like. And it's like, these are the three steps to do this thing to get this one specific outcome from your child. And in here, it's like so much of this is about the parent and the work that we're doing and how we're conducting and holding ourselves. And especially in the chapter about, I forget exactly how you phrase it, but it's like how, like to ready to go, like how much time does it take from saying like, it's time to go until you actually can go. And as I was reading that, there was just so much acceptance for what is, and not instead of like changing or these like five steps to like get your kid to put their shoes on fast. It's like, how long does it take your kid to put their shoes on? Okay, that is how much time that you need. It wasn't so much about shortening that window, just accepting what it is and kind of how to self-contain within that. And I think that is what resonated so much with me about this, is that because largely I'm really only in control of myself, and then constructing a container to hopefully guide my child. But I don't view my role as like controlling them. It's like containing myself and then like creating boundaries and supports for them. And I think that's what you did so brilliantly in here.
I mean, I have tried in my lifetime to control children. It doesn't work. The only way to really control children is through fear. And I am not interested. And if you take fear out of the equation, then obedience goes with it. And then it becomes, okay, this is a collaborative process. It's an improvisational activity, which we perform every single day. And the goal is to get to the end with everybody still feeling pretty good about themselves and each other, while also, you know, minding what needs to be minded, right? Like, we do have to sometimes get out of the house. And the reason that got its own whole chapter is, right, again, like, our household is not great at it.
Neither is ours.
And so I don't know a lot of people who are, like, especially people who have more than one child. I definitely know a few people who are two adults and one kid. And their one kid is, you know, a sort of organized and practical child by nature. And sometimes they say I know that they don't know better, and I love them and forgive them, even though sometimes I have to stop listening. But they'll be like, oh, I just say it's time to leave. And then we go. And I'm like, well, that's great for you. I can't, right? Like, God bless your heart.
That's amazing.
But I am aware that that's just like luck and temperament, in the exact same way that, like, you could wake me from a sound sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning, hand me a microphone and tell me it's time to do an hour in front of 1,000 people about any one of a number of topics. And I would be like, okay. Right. Because that is within my capacity. And if you wanted to teach somebody how to do that, it would take a really long time. But I think you're right. Like, as parents, we can control ourselves and our own abilities and reactions to some degree. But, like, if you're not, I feel that enjoying parenting and enjoying your children requires a collaborative mindset. Even when you feel like you are on the group project from hell and you're the only one who is doing your parts of it and everybody else is slacking, like, sometimes that's what it's like, you know? And that is a very good example of that kind of a thing. Like, I probably could terrify my youngest child until he put on his socks and shoes before I had to ask him to. Like, I'm sure that I could organize the circumstances such that it was so unpleasant to forget that he always remembered. But that seems terrible for everyone. I don't want to make him afraid. I don't want him to be afraid. And as if on cue, he has appeared. And he's just outside the door. Do you want to pop your face in and say hello?
Am I
going to
be in a podcast now?
Yes. Come say
Yay!
Hi.
Hello.
We're talking about the fact that I have not solved the problem of you getting your socks and shoes on by making you afraid that there will be terrible punishment if you don't do it
right
away.
Yeah, I'm not afraid, and my socks aren't always the way most people put their socks on.
That is also true. You have a very interesting relationship.
Well, I love you. Have a good
socks.
Podcast.
I love you also, too. Thank you.
What podcast am I in now?
It's called Scratch That.
I just want to know what podcast I missed.
There you go. Enjoy.
Enjoy.
I love you.
Oh my God.
I love.
I think the like talking to someone who carries the presence that you do, based on my history of how men parent, and hearing you talk about raising your kids without fear just makes me so emotional because I was, I know exactly how I could get my kid to behave in the ways that I want him too. I was raised on it. I was trained in it. And I actively am not doing that. And when I'm not doing it, then I'm also constantly feeling the weight of judgment, whether I'm projecting that onto people and then taking it back in or if it's real.
There's a lot of like, oh, congratulations to people who are breaking cycles of abuse. And like, that's real. And I very much appreciate it. But nobody talks about the fact that it is exhausting to try and parent in a different way than your parents parented you. And also, like, not only is it exhausting because you sort of constantly have to innovate, but it's also exhausting because you're constantly trying to guess if you're doing it right. And sometimes the results are not available for like a decade.
That's what it is. It's the results are so immediate the other way. And people can look in and be like, well, our way works. And it's like, well, but then we're in therapy and like we're not okay in our 30s. And I'm really trying to parent that my kid is okay in his 30s and less interested in whether or not he's flinging clods of mud and dirt at the house while I'm trying to mop the floors inside. But on the outs, it's nerve-wracking to parent.
Yes.
In that mm-hmm. way, especially mm-hmm. if you are like moving through the world in ways that are already counter-cultural. And so you just feel like a lot of scrutiny.
Absolutely. And like, I think a lot about what are the qualities that I value in my friends today? Mm-hmm. Like, who do I adore and why? And it's not because they're quiet or obedient mm-hmm. or that they don't question authority, right? Like, I love all of my, you know, fully self-actualized, rabble-rousing activist organizer friends and my like weirdo nerd friends who are still like super into the thing that they're super into and do not have, like, could not be paid to care whether it's cool or not. You know, and so, yeah, I'm trying to parent toward the idea that who are the adults. But it's not easy, right? Like, it's exhausting to parent without relying on fear to create obedience, and instead to rely on, like, really sort of having every, like, creating the expectation that everything's a team activity. Because I don't always want to coach a team. Sometimes I would love to just have a clipboard and to be a supervisor and be like, do this or you're fired. And have everybody just go off and immediately do exactly what I said in the way that I said to do it. Like, that sounds very relaxing, actually. The problem is that it all doesn't, you know, do any of the other things that I want to do in the long term.
And I think it's like the beauty and magic. Like, when I'm like well rested and I've like remembered to eat enough protein and taken all my meds, I'm like just, I relish in this. I'm like, this is a beautiful moment. But I'm often not well rested. And I ate Oreos for breakfast instead of like Greek yogurt. And I didn't take magnesium the night before.
Yes, all of that. It's never the situation you imagined. It's always like standing on one foot.
Interrupting this episode to say thank you to everyone supporting the podcast on Patreon.
We love seeing your comments come through. We love getting to know each of you better. Like, you being there really means the world to us.
If you want to support the project financially, you can become a paying patron for as low as $5 a month. That's less than a latte.
But there's lots of free ways to support the podcast too. Sharing episodes, giving us one of those very pretty 5-star reviews, all of that makes a huge difference too.
And you can also join Patreon without paying. So the show notes will always be there for you. Okay, back to the show.
One thing that Caitlin and I have been thinking about a lot is honing and identifying like core values for our family. And we do like values card exercises. And you and your chapter, when they're small, you can teach them 2 or 3 things and that's it. So choose wisely. Was like underlined and circled and starred all over the place for me. But one of the things that I have struggled with or that I find hard in identifying the core values or traits that we really want to focus on, because we can only focus on so many, is like letting go of the other things, like even things I care about, like just being like, this is not going to be the priority. This is we're going to have to let this one go indefinitely for a time, you know, like this is just something we're not going to prioritize, even something I care about. What are the things that you have deprioritized or let go of that you really care about?
I have let go of a lot of cleanliness and tidiness and organization. I have let go of some of the stuff about, like, when I was a kid, I had sort of imagined that it would be important to retain a certain amount of, like, etiquette stuff, partly because I am a little bit of an etiquette nerd. I have a lot of very strong feelings about things like, you know, how you address people based on and what you do on the, and don't get me started on things like how you are supposed to, you know, send an invitation or respond to an invitation or whatever. And that I was, you know, I had the idea that our kids would, you know, call adults like Ms. something or Mr. something or Mix something and whatever, and that they would wipe their feet and sit politely on other people's couches and not touch stuff and do, you know, whatever. None of that happened, like, at all. They are very able to just, like, talk to people, though, which is really helpful. But I think at a certain point, I was I started to realize, okay, I think the current moment, it is actually more important to encourage them to be able to make friends and talk to people and have conversations and accomplish like commerce, to like go ask or order their own meal, ask for extra napkins in a way that is polite, like, you know, things like that, rather than making sure that, you know, they're sort of following all of these forms. That really came up for me. You know, part of what's happening also now is that my youngest is 10. And so the days of, you know, having to let a lot of stuff go in order to focus on the really critical items, the things that felt foundational, have passed. Right? Like, we are now into the part where, you know, we're out of, you can only teach them a couple of things, and into, they're going to watch and listen to everything you say, so make good choices. But the days of like, what do I want to address in this entire situation? I need to let go of, you know, I said, take one cookie in the hotel lobby and you took three cookies, and I asked you to get the luggage cart and instead you started jumping on it while singing Surfin' USA, all have to be let go in favor of the fact that somebody else in the lobby looked notably different in some bodily way. And what I want to talk about right now is I really need to reinforce that that is a way that people look, and people, you know, bodies are all different, and that is what's important, and that I feel like I want to take the moment to say, right, like, A plus, good work for not staring or being weird or doing some of the things that we saw other in the people in the lobby choosing to do. And this is what we mean when we talk about the fact that everyone is entitled to enjoy their, you know, clothes, their body, their human self in comfort and respect. And that was the most important thing in this moment. So, like, do I love it that you turned the luggage cart into a surfboard and started singing Beach Boys songs about it? I do not. Do I love it that you snitched an extra cookie while you thought I wasn't looking and then attempted to blame it on your sibling? I don't. However, the part that feels most important, that you engaged with someone in a respectful and appropriate way that really honored everyone's humanity, especially when we saw that other people were not doing that, that's the key piece. So I'm letting go of the cookie snitching and the attempt to evade cookie snitching responsibility and the gross misuse of a luggage cart and the, you know, singing when you're supposed to be offloading the car, in order to focus on the piece that feels critical, which is that, you know, this kid with a very different looking face obviously felt really under scrutiny, and your choice to just be like, hey, what's up, rather than, you know, what's wrong with you, or what happened to your face, or like, Papa, what's the matter with that kid, or whatever. Like, we did the critical thing in the moment. Let's take the time to review and give positive reinforcement about that, because Right. And that for me is the thing about imagining them at 30. Like if they're 30 and still sneaking an extra cookie or turning the luggage cart into a surfboard, I don't really care. If they're 30 and they've turned into one of those people who make shitty judgmental comments about what other people look like in a way that maybe they can't hear, but they definitely know that they're being talked about. That's not, I don't want that. I don't want any part of it. And so, you know, sometimes it's just a question of, out of everything that's happening right now, what is the one thing that feels critical? So like, did you drop your soda all over the floor? Yes. Did I need to remind you 3 times to clean it up? Yes. But did we speak to each other in a relatively respectful way the entire time? Yes. Okay. That's what's important. I don't want to clean up a sticky mess. I don't want to remind somebody to clean up a sticky mess. But the actual important part is that when I said, like, okay, it's time to clean up this sticky mess, nobody said, I don't wanna, I hate you, or whatever. It was just like, okay, but I understand that you don't want to, and that's okay. I don't need you to want to. I do, however, need you to do it. So, like, will we be doing it with a paper towel, or will we be doing it with a tea towel?
So clarifying. I love the specific example with the surfboard and the cookies and like you were saying, Caitlin, so much of the parenting books are focusing on like that behavior in that moment versus who are you becoming. And if we can pick one thing, and I also like, Bear, that you're pointing out, like, it's not like, what's the one thing we need, let's focus on the one thing we need to fix in that moment. But it's actually like, what's the most important thing? And maybe the most important thing is affirming something that's already right, as opposed to like choosing the one thing we want to fix. I love that.
Feedback is powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm feeling comforted in hearing that, like, we don't have, I think sometimes, because we have 4 and 5 year olds right now. And sometimes it's like I can only pick 3 things for the rest of his life that matter. And it's like, oh, actually in like 5 or 6 years, those 3 things might turn into 6 things but we will have built the foundation. And I think that those might still remain our like core tenets of what matters, but we can just keep building on them. And that feels like really liberating. Like I can be like, okay, these are the 3 things for like this phase. And like, okay, we'll add these 3 things in like 4 years or something, or like slowly they're like the side dishes, and then it will, I don't know, turn into a casserole.
The other thing that I'm thinking about that I think we're definitely putting a link to Bear's book in the show notes, because I think a lot of our listeners would really benefit from sitting with and reading and rereading this book. I wanted to say in this conversation, I think part of what is really useful about your book is that it prompts reflection that leads to like intentionality, because the moment that you're describing with the surfboard and the cookies and the person in the lobby that looks different, it's all coming at us so fast. Like they're all like, it's the next one, and then we're in the next one, and like it's so much like instinct and like reaction. And I think what's really helpful about choosing those 2 or 3 values is really just as a tool for clarification that you can like actually hold on to each time and know already, these are the things that are important to us and we will always go back to them. And it doesn't mean we can't have side dishes and build and whatever, but like just to have the clarity for when things are coming at you so fast and when you're sleep deprived. That's one of my favorite things about your book too, is like just how many times you reference how tired we are. So tired. Why won't the children sleep? Yeah. So I love the way that you frame it in the book and helping people ask these questions to help us choose what those things are.
Okay. The chapter, if I could only take one chapter with me out of this book, it would be the family garden versus the family tree. That is the chapter that when I like came to it, I was like full on started crying. And then I reread it the whole book this weekend, and I came to that again, and I was just like, it feels so personally to me, it feels really, really, it gave me a framework and a script for how to talk about things that I don't know how to talk about that are like really painful for me. So I would love to hear you talk about like how you came to this or what you're thinking about it. So the idea is that instead of a family tree, you have a family garden. And the piece of this that's so beautiful to me is that some things don't grow well next to each other. Some things like mint need to be in their own specific pot. And the seasonality of like when things bloom and you really get to enjoy them and soak them all up. And then other times there's this like fallow ground and there's space between. And then there's the things that are growing year round and then are like snuggled up really close to each other. And that just both because I have a lot of feelings about who Charlie gets to know and doesn't know and why in my family. And also to Charlie, as of now, as of the sense that he's kind of making of the world, it's easy, I think, for him to presume us to be this like cishet monogamous family. And we're like, you know, we talk about those things, but in an outward way, that is often how people read us. And so it gives me space to talk to him about the ways that we're not like that, but also for him to see all these other configurations of family, like every family. We've been talking so much lately about how every family doesn't have a mom and dad. Like there could be two dads or two moms or like multiple moms and dads, or just a single parent. I'm rambling. This thing I really want to know is like, do you have a worksheet? How do I fill this out? But like, how has this gone, like actually explaining it to kids or families, and how are that people using it?
It goes well for little kids. Very often, I encourage parents and teachers, like in the, you know, actual practical, how do I do this thing? Like if I was doing, you know, professional development for a second grade teacher or whatever, is people use stickers and they like decide which flower or plant or fruit or whatever is most like each of the people. And then we sort of talk about like, okay, who's you and who do you want close? And who, you know, and we sort of talk it through in categories, like who, you know, has your same weather and where do the other people go? And, you know, I think that some of the, and then as they get older, some of the more complicated concepts come into play, but the thing is that, like, if they have the concept of the family garden starting when they're little, then it becomes sort of an ongoing family, like a metaphor that you all have in common that you can return to talk about things like, why don't we talk to Aunt Petunia anymore? Or what is, you know, how does it work if, you know, Sudeep has two moms and a dad since I saw right over the summer or like whatever, you know, Sudeep's original parents got divorced and one of them took up with a woman and now there's two moms, right? Like, so it sort of becomes a way to help them map their own family when they're younger, a way to sort of talk about like other people's family garden. What will it look like if this, if that, if the other thing, you know, or, and also, you know, some amount of imagining what other people's family gardens would look like, oh, so-and-so is, you know, lives with her grandparents. So, you know, her people that are closest in the garden would be, you know, Nana and Grandpa or whatever. They can write their own name. They can write your name. They can talk about, like, who's important and who do they get to see and who do they wish they saw more and, you know, all of those things, whatever. I've seen people do versions where they have, like, you know, the sunny part of the garden and the shady part of the garden, where, like, the sunny part is the people that they get to see every day and the shady part is the people that they don't see as much as they want to, but are still in their family and still, you know, very beloved. Or ones that make a distinction between, like, who's in my household and who's in my family. There are a lot of ways. It's a very flexible metaphor, which is helpful. You know, and it came about, honestly, in large part because as an American Jew with a lot of relatives who, you know, big swaths of my, like, people who should be on my family tree, but instead are in a mass grave at Auschwitz or Bergen-Belsen, right? Like, when it came time to do family trees, I had a very different experience than a lot of my classmates who were like, here are, you know, 13 generations of my family back to the Mayflower. And I was like, here are 3 generations of my family, and these are the people, we don't know what happened to them. I'm not adopted. I didn't have, you know, my parents didn't divorce. Like, but as a child, you know, there's a lot of reasons that someone's family garden might be or family tree might be complicated, right? Like, I didn't see, you know, my mom had a brother that I rarely spent time with as a kid, but I had a great aunt that I was very close with. And then another very close friend of my grandmother's, who I didn't actually know that I wasn't related to until I was pretty old. Like, you know, all of these are ways that a family garden makes room that I really love. And I think queer families especially, like, the value of our chosen family is never represented on a family tree.
Listening to you talk this whole time, but especially in this last, like, garden metaphor piece, I'm thinking back on the words I started with in describing you, which was humility and authority, which neither of those sound perfectly right, or sturdy and open. And I think the combination, like, the word that maybe describes what I'm trying to get at is flexibility. And you used that word in describing garden, right? It's just very flexible. And so much of what we're trying to do in this podcast is take those rigid scripts and figure out new models and in new ways of telling the story. And I think maybe part of why Caitlin and I are feeling a little obsessed is that you offer a lot of flexible scripts, which we're really hungry for. So I'm taking back a step back from my humility authority words, and I'm saying flexible is a lot of what you're offering. And I think that's so needed. And all of the ways you just named with the garden, there's so many reasons why a garden makes more sense than a tree for so many families, for so many reasons.
But of course, what is hilarious is that anybody who knows me will tell you I am not naturally very flexible at all.
It's hard earned.
I am notorious for being the sort of person who's like, oh, yes, I have scheduled spontaneity for Wednesday between 1 and 5. Right. Or like, I am the one who plans ahead to the point that like, our family agreement is that I am the one who does the planning ahead. But then if the plan falls apart, my ability to just kind of roll with it, not great. My husband is the one who at that point I have to be like, you have to figure out what happens next, because I will just keep trying to return to the original plan no matter what it costs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that my... Right, like, the flexibility is hard won every time I manage to make space for more things than, like, the one thing I think is best feels. And that's why this book ended up with, I think, a half a dozen chapters that are just called Strong Opinions.
Yes. Yeah.
The places where I tried, and that was an evolution that came out of the fact that I tried really hard for all of the chapters to be like, let's think about it together. And if this is what you want, then you can do this thing. And here is what I tried. And then but there were a few places where I was like, no, I actually really believe that there are some things that I don't want to be flexible about. I just...
Like, no Caillou.
No Caillou. Ever. No.
That chapter made me laugh so hard. I was just like, thank you. Someone said it. And it's just so specific and not... There's like no apology. It's just like, here are the facts.
No one should ever ask me about Thomas the Tank Engine. You will get...
I could go for days.
A whole thing. If there were, I have many feelings about Thomas the Tank Engine and the show, and none of them are good.
Okay, Bear, you can opt out of this question. We just, completely. This is just we're throwing a tiny question here at the end. We, for our podcast, we have been building this collaborative playlist that all of our listeners have contributed to, and that our guests, we invite them to participate in it if wanted or if it feels right. So we are each of us like contributing a song to this playlist that is a song that has held us or brought us back to ourselves, either across the lifespan or maybe during a period of our lives, that like a song we came back to again and again.
There is a song by Patty Larkin, who's a folk singer, which is called Might As Well Dance. And it's from her Angels Running album, I think. This is like the 90s. And it is one of those songs, I included it in my very first ever solo show. And it is a song that for me is very like, you know, it sort of encapsulates the vibe of a lot of things are difficult, but you retain the choice to find some joy anyway. And to me, it has always felt very bound up with my mid-90s work with like Queer Nation and other of my sort of teenage queer activism about this idea that, like, you know, powerful forces may indeed be arrayed against you, but there are still choices to be made about how I meet that moment. And, you know, there are certainly many other songs across my lifetime that have felt, you know, validating or useful or important as I have moved through many phases. And I have, you know, a million playlists of like, you know, now it's time to do a hard thing songs, like let's have a day songs. But I think that if there's one that's sort of, that goes way back for me. So if I'm contributing one song to the Scratch That collaborative playlist, I think it's definitely not a fashionable contribution, but I would say that is probably my choice.
I love it. I'm so glad we asked you. I can't wait to listen to it. So we'll add it to the playlist. Thank you for sharing it. All right. I just want to say, before we hop off, that some of the things that I wrote in the margins of your book included, so relatable. OMG, yes. I love you. Thank you. LOLOL, literally yes. Holy shit. So that is my advertisement to go check out this beautiful book, Special Topics in Being a Parent, A Queer and Tender Guide to Things I've Learned About Parenting Mostly the Hard Way.
And the Special Topics in Being a Human, which I am halfway through right now. The way you speak about anger in there felt so incredibly liberating to me. So that's a whole other conversation. But that, like, but just buy them as a set. This is, yeah. And thank you for being here and for, like, being willing to jump in.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm super happy to be here and do this. And I appreciate your good questions. Sometimes I do interviews and I feel like, oh, I've done this interview before. So it's always very nice to do interviews where I feel like I also learn a little more through the process of trying to contextualize or explain. So this has been great.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Take care.
You tell me when we're done, okay?
This podcast is edited and perfected by the most beautiful wizard and my favorite dude, Micah Jones.
For all the show notes and a transcript of today's episode, check out our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast. This is our hub. It's where you can join the conversation and be part of our community.
If today's episode resonated with you or made you think of someone, share it.
And if you want to support the pod and also make us glow inside, go give a 5-star review on Apple. That would be so lovely.
Thank you for being here, for listening, for being a part of this community.
We love you so much.